Welcome to the Hunger for Change podcast, the platform where we dive deep into the health world and challenge the status quo. I'm your host, Niklas Gustafsson, and today I'm thrilled to introduce our guest, Dr. Tina Moore. With nearly three decades of experience in the medical field, Dr. Moore stands out as a leading expert in holistic regenerative medicine and resilient health. Her approach isn't just about treating symptoms. It's about understanding and addressing the root causes to build a robust foundation for long-term well-being. Beyond her clinical expertise, Dr. Moore is an influential voice in health and wellness. As the host of the Dr. Tina Show podcast, a best-selling author, and an acclaimed speaker, she champions resilience and metabolic health. She mentors health professionals towards more independent practices and inspires others to actively manage their health. In today's chat, Dr. Moore is going to help us to understand how simple changes in our daily habits and holistic approaches can make a huge difference in our health. And just to give you a glimpse of the person behind the expertise, she's not only a health guru, but also a loving mother, a kettlebell fan, and a dog lover. Let's give a warm welcome to Dr. Tina Moore. Perfect. Thank you so much for being with us today. First of all, what does health mean to you, Tina?
What does health mean to me? Oh, gosh, that's a great question. I think of health as freedom. If you have your health and you have your vitality, you have the ability to do the things that you need to do in life. And without hesitation, you can travel, you can move, you can explore, you can play, you can have joy and adventures. And those things quickly diminish when you don't have your health. And it's not until you lose it, which I have lost my health before, and you realize all of the things that you're missing simply by living with chronic illness. So yeah, health to me is freedom.
Yeah, that's such a great answer. I totally agree. Could you share with us what inspired you to pursue a career in holistic regenerative medicine?
Oh, that's a long story, but I'll keep it short. I was a really sick little kid, and I mean, right out the womb, I was a really sick little kid, and I was put on antibiotics almost immediately. My mother took me from doctor to doctor and expert to expert, trying to find answers. It was a long haul, and I got the best answers that I could get from my holistic physician. So my mother always took me to a chiropractor, and chiropractors were always very, very helpful. And then I met a naturopathic physician right out of college, and he was such a brilliant man. And I became his receptionist, and he took me under his wing, and I spent in total about 20 years mentoring with him. And he was really a great master. I was truly mentored by a master, which was amazing. And so I followed my heart. I went to chiropractic college, and then I followed his advice, and I went through naturopathic school, which in the United States, there are a few credentialed naturopathic colleges, and we actually are licensed as physicians in a few states. There's also fake naturopathic training, which is like a health coach program, not the same thing. It gets confusing, but I went through the physician version. And so I was looking for answers for myself, for my family, for my daughter. My daughter was starting to show glimmers of health issues that I had had as a child, and I didn't want her to go through the same thing I went through. So really for me, I think for many of us, right, it's a journey of self-discovery.
Yeah. What would you say have been the most significant changes that you've witnessed in holistic medicine? Because you've been doing this for three decades, right?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. I don't feel that old. Gosh, I'm almost 50.
I'm older.
Oh, you're older. Well, you look wonderful. So, oh, good. Good for you. You're Swedish, though. You Swedes don't age. You guys just get better with
age.
You
look Swedish. You could be Swedish.
I'm a mutt. I don't know what I am, but I appreciate that. You know, I wasn't very healthy as a young person. I chain smoked. I drank way too much alcohol. I was a disaster as a teenager. So what you see here is really the build back. But what have I seen change? I've seen so much change. You know, what's really interesting is so many of the biohacking things I hear about online are things that my mentor was doing 35 years ago in his practice. You know, like,
really?
it's so interesting to see how everything's come full circle. And nothing is new, really. I mean, there's a few new ideas, but really nothing is new again. And we just are building upon what we already knew. I think that the difference is the information was quite hidden and it was quite suppressed back then and it was much smaller. And now, of course, it's become far more mainstream and it's much more available. I think that's what it is. People want answers, yes. And I know that it's confusing trying to sort through all the information, but the information that we had coveted as holistic doctors is now mainstream and you can find it anywhere with a few clicks of the, you know, into the Google. So I think that's probably the biggest change is information overload and social media. I mean, that just took all the secrets that people were hiding in their offices and in their lives and like.
So much easier to bring it out to spread knowledge, right?
Yeah. If the censors would back off, that's something I've watched morph is the censorship of health information, and it's real, and it's not just since COVID, it's prior to that.
Do you see more censorship today than 10 years ago?
10 years ago, if you said that cholesterol was not bad for you and statin drugs were bad for you, you were a quack. You know, you were called a quack and quickly dismissed. And so a lot of the ideas that I held in my practice really weren't even held by the masses of my colleagues. A lot of my colleagues, like I was testing for metabolic health way back when, and that's something my mentor really drilled into me. And I remember getting called names by my naturopathic colleagues saying, well, Tina thinks everything's metabolic health. Tina thinks everything's insulin resistance. Why would you run a serum insulin on a patient if they don't have diabetes? I mean, that was how, you know, coming out of school, that's what they were. And these are naturopathic physicians. So that was surprising. I was also in chiropractic college. I graduated from chiropractic college in 2008. And I distinctly remember getting into it with my professor in one of our courses, because she was vehemently convinced that food and what you ate had nothing to do with your rheumatoid arthritis or any of these other musculoskeletal conditions that were inflammatory. And I was like, Are you high? Like, what are you talking about? So I think the other thing I've seen shift is a lot of the professions used to have a lot of turf wars, and now we're intermingling quite a bit. So, you know, the nurse practitioners are friends with the strength and conditioning coaches, are friends with the chiropractors, or, you know, we're working together.
Yeah.
And I think that's come even, you know, really full force since the internet and even these past few years, as we've seen some medical tyranny come down, we've seen a lot of people, you know, we know what teams people are on, and you're either team medical freedom and truth or, you know, you're not.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. How would you define holistic regenerative medicine, and why do you believe it's crucial for modern health?
Well, the body's inherent ability to regenerate is something that we're never taught. It's never discussed. And I think that you as an athlete understand this inherently, and I understand it because we regenerate ourselves, right? Like that's part of healing, and we get hurt and I mean, I don't know what you do when you're hurt, but generally I just keep moving. I mean, that's right. Like you keep going. And so what I did was I injected natural substances into people's joints to regenerate them. This was long before stem cells, long before platelet-rich plasma. My mentor was using and taught me to use sugar. So just dextrose, just plain regular sugar injected into a joint actually causes not only a reduction in pain, but regeneration. Osmotically, it draws the immune system into the area. So, you know, tendons and ligaments don't heal well. And it's because they don't have a good vascular supply. They don't have a good bed of vessels to heal them. And so what we would do is we'd actually take the needle and pepper the tendon or ligament or the injured tissue, and we would inject it with dextrose. And the results were phenomenal. This is the key treatment that I had in my practice for over a decade. My favorite treatment is called prolotherapy. And that really opened up this whole idea to me that, you know, anything and everything is regenerative if applied correctly. I was just talking to a plastic surgeon, a holistic plastic surgeon, and he was describing how when we needle the skin, we regenerate collagen. That's exactly the same thing I was doing in the joints. And I do think, especially in the past few years, people were really convinced that they weren't going to be able to withstand, you know, something that was going around, or that they weren't going to be able to heal or survive certain things. And I just think that's hogwash. How we eat, how we move, how we manage our stress, how we live our life, our lifestyle factors, all of those contribute to how well we're going to rebound and how resilient we're going to be to something. And to me, that's all regenerative medicine in a bag.
Interesting. Those the injections, is it always dextrose or do you use any other substances?
Well, so it started with dextrose and also other sclerosing agents. They would even use pumice way back when. It was pretty hardcore when I learned this, but dextrose is really safe. That's the cool thing. When you're getting a cortisone injection into your joint, which is usually the standard of care when people go to see their orthopedic surgeon, they get cortisone. Cortisone will inhibit the inflammatory response temporarily and make you feel better, but it melts your tissue.
It's really, and it's very short term, right?
Yeah. And it's really devastating.
For days.
Days to weeks, maybe. But it ultimately melts the tissues. And the reason the joint is falling apart in the first place is because it's unstable and cortisone contributes to more instability. So it's a big mess. You know, it's just, it's really a, it's a bad band-aid, if you will. And so when you put dextrose in a joint, it regenerates. So not only do you get the pain, same pain reduction or some very similar, but you get a regenerative response, which is awesome. So then we graduated in the, oh gosh, I would say the early 2000s, we started injecting PRP, which is platelet-rich plasma. You draw the patient's blood, you spin out the platelets. The platelets have growth factors. You re-inject those, that layer of cells back into the patient. It's an in-house procedure. It's very easy to do. Really, really powerful. So that, you know, and it's only as good as the person's blood is, though. All of these treatments are only as good as a person's ability to heal. So if you take a smoker or somebody who can't even heal a small cut on their finger, they're not going to respond well to any of these. And then we graduated up by the time I left practice in 2018, 2019. And by the time I left practice, we were doing stem cells. We were harvesting stem cells from patients' fat and bone marrow and injecting that back in. And that's a big, you know, that's a big shotgun approach. But some of these other therapies, like I mentioned, prolotherapy, very affordable, very, very elegant if done correctly and really effective. So it kind of grows up on what's in the syringe, but the technique is always the same. We're still peppering to draw blood.
Good. So talking about pain, what are some common misconceptions about managing pain naturally that you encounter in your practice?
That's a really good question. No one's ever asked me that. You'd think they would. I think the one thing that people could rarely wrap their heads around, they would always confuse them, is that what they were eating was a direct player in their pain levels. That really baffled a lot of people who came in. I'd have patients come in and they'd be like, what does what I eat have to do with anything? And I'm like, it has to do with everything. That's a big one. If you're eating a really highly inflammatory diet, it's nutrient poor, it's, you know, full of refined carbohydrates, it's spiking your insulin all the time, you're just chronically in a state of non-healing and actually degradation, if you will. So being in that high insulin resistant kind of pre-diabetic state, which most Americans are in, most US adults are in, is really just, you're just sort of swimming in this inability to heal. It really dumps out your immune system and it puts a lot of fire into the system. So diet, I think another big one is movement. People are afraid to move. They think movement's going to make a joint hurt worse when it's entirely the opposite.
Exactly. That's the opposite. I totally agree.
Yeah. It's, I mean, if you don't move your joints have a capsule around them called your synovial capsule. And to have osmotic diffusion in and out of that, we've got to get nutrients in and we've got to get garbage out. And the only way that happens is if you move the joint. And so we have to load the joint, you know, squats, heavy squats don't destroy knees. Running doesn't destroy knees. What destroys knees is metabolic dysfunction, which really most osteoarthritis and osteoporosis is just diabetes of the joints and the bones. So, you know, people being metabolically dysfunctional, and then on top of it, they're dehydrated. And so cartilage layers start to slough off and degrade because they're not getting what they need. And then the person's told, oh, you have bone on bone, stop moving. It's just the worst advice in the world. Like, I'm a big fan of moving through things. If you need to hire help to do that, then do so. You know, I have overtrained myself into joint pain as well, but I would say by and large, most people undertrain themselves into joint pain.
Yeah, I agree. So what advice would you give to someone who's been dealing with chronic pain for a long time, maybe for years?
Well, the other thing that I think is most important is the brain. The brain can become inflamed, and a lot of people have neuroinflammation and don't know it. And that top-down pain is what's kind of driving the train. And so while they may be manifesting with specific joints that hurt, it may very well be something that's going on with the brain and or the body. They may have some kind of systemic inflammatory condition going on, like a systemic inflammatory arthritis, which is not that uncommon. And they're just getting low grades of it. And it's not until they get really severe that it's diagnosed. And I think this is missed very often, that the immune system really has a big part in people's pain. And so does their nervous system. And so I think that the first thing to do is make sure you start moving. It's going to hurt worse before it gets better, but start moving. Even if that's simple walking, keep moving. That's the worst thing you can do, is to stop. That usually will help people sleep better once they start moving more and kind of burning off that. We're like little kids and dogs. You know, I was showing my puppy before, like I've got to burn off his steam before he'll lay down. So if we get the sleep piece in order, I think that's a huge driver of pain, is people having their sleep disrupted. And so we've got those two pieces, and then people will tend to start to eat better, really focusing on, I prefer focusing on animal protein, because you can't make collagen unless you ingest collagen. And so I'm a big fan of getting people to eat whatever kind of collagen that they will, and get, you know, some substrate in there to start rebuilding themselves. And then get sun. Sun is a huge pain reliever. Yeah, yeah. Sun is my favorite. Like if you have pain, and obviously don't go out and burn yourself, but if you have pain, and you probably know this, you know, you look like somebody who enjoys the sun as well, like getting some sunlight on that area that hurts, especially back pain, is huge. And then I live in Oregon where it rains all the time, and it's so cloudy and crummy, and like my pain goes way up in the winter here. So I know there's something to that, you know, snowbirding they do here in the US, where they all go to Arizona in the winter to offset their joint pain. I get it. So that's it, you know, move, sleep, eat well, and then mitigate stress. But all of those things I just mentioned will help you mitigate your stress. And if you don't do them, and you just try to meditate your stress away, you're going to go crazy.
Yeah, I agree. So talking about sun exposure, because I heard you talk about that in another podcast, what would you do to debunk the myths behind sun exposure? See the benefits of sun exposure.
Well, the sun is more than vitamin D, right? The sun is infrared. The sun is warm. The sun is so many wonderful things. And the fact that we got scared away from it is so confusing. And there's actually a great Swedish study. They looked at a great Swedish study several years back where they looked at like tens of thousands of Swedish women, and the women who sunbathed regularly had significantly longer, healthier lives. I mean, just across the board, right? Like they just were healthier and happier and lived longer. And I remember that study coming out because I was trying to convince my classmates back in medical school that the sun was good for them, and they all just thought I was crazy. And then that study came out, well, I think it was right when I was graduating, and I was like, ha! Yeah. Yeah. Also, our mitochondria, in a roundabout way, we photosynthesize, and people don't realize that, right? Your mitochondria is the powerhouse of your cell. Without them, you would die. They are bacterial in origin. They are symbiotic. It's crazy. Mm. Like they're crazy organisms that live in us and make our cells run, and they need the sun. They need the sun to work appropriately. So those are two things that I always think of, but the fear around sun, we don't have a really good, you know, we don't have really good data on this, but the increase in skin cancer, at least in the United States, probably worldwide, also coincides with the increase in seed oils in our diet. So that's a huge, huge factor. And we didn't call them seed oils. I'm kind of old school. We called them omega-6s back in the day. And we were like, hey, avoid the omega-6s. But basically seed oils, which is what everyone's cooking in, those do terrible things to your cells, and they oxidize your skin. So that's not great. And then people are, again, poorly nourished. They're malnourished. They're overfed and malnourished generally. And they don't have a high intake of high-end antioxidant foods and other foods that are going to be protective. Yeah. And so I think it's just kind of a mess. And then on top of it, people like to drink alcohol in the sun, which will contribute to premature aging, but really doesn't help you with the UV damage that may occur. Yeah. So And I think of the sun, like anything else, it's kind of hormetic. Hormesis is this idea that, you know, small incremental doses of stress make the organism stronger. And we're not going out. I'm not saying go out and cook yourself into oblivion, but definitely getting 20 minutes a day of direct sunlight is like, to me, that's like the anti-aging secret.
Yeah, totally. Totally. But for people that live in areas with less sunlight, what alternatives would you suggest to compensate, right, for the lack of sun exposure?
Well, that sucks because I'm one of them. And I grew up in Southern California, so I'm like a beach baby. I love the sun so much. So I actually take trips to the sun as often as I can. Yeah. And even if it's just for a weekend and I'm heading to a conference in Arizona, even if I don't get to lay in the sun for very long, just seeing the sun, just being in that climate is really, really helpful for me. So I try to get to the sun as much as possible. Another thing that I've implemented that's been so helpful is just an inexpensive red light. You know, they don't need to cost a lot of money, but having red light for me in the morning and then in the afternoon is that when the sun's setting, just getting that on my eyes has really helped my rhythm, my circadian rhythm and my sleep during the winter. Cause I get kind of, it gets crazy here. It gets so gray sometimes all day long that you don't know what time of day it is. It's wild. Yeah. And it's not for everyone. And I don't know how I keep doing it, but I keep doing it. So anyway, I think red light can be very helpful. I'm not a big fan of tanning beds. I realize there is some benefit. I use them for a long time. I do think that they can contribute to skin cancers, probably more so than the sun even would. And so I'm not a huge fan there. I also don't think, if you look at the types of skin cancers, melanoma being the really dangerous one, that one isn't the most aggressive forms of melanoma actually show up where the sun doesn't shine. So I'm not completely convinced those are.
Yeah. It's more common in the in Northern Europe than in Southern Europe, actually.
Wow. Yeah. It's crazy, right? And it shows up on the palms and inside the mucosa. And like, so I think we've kind of gotten that story wrong. And in fact, a lot of the ingredients in the chemical sunscreens actually promote skin cancer. So I think, and they tank out testosterone. We've really kind of messed things up for humans. I am not afraid of the sun. I try to eat well. I try to make sure I really gobble down some pomegranate seeds or dark chocolate or blueberries when I get out of the sun, or some green tea, you know, hit the antioxidants, avoid the alcohol, and hope for the best. I'd rather die tan and happy, because the cancers that are linked to low vitamin D levels are the ones you do not want, like breast cancer, colon cancer, prostate. Yeah. So,
Tina, you just mentioned hormesis, and I heard you talking about that. Could you explain this concept and how it applies to overall health?
Yeah, I love hormesis.
Hormesis, that's how you pronounce it. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. Hormesis. Oh, it's okay. Or however you want to. It's small incremental doses of stress that you put on the body, and then you rest and refeed the body, and the body regenerates. That's regenerative medicine, right? So a good example is, I'm not great with my house plants, and I will neglect them a little bit until they get kind of droopy, and then I water them and they go crazy. And they actually, this is how you force bloom some of these Christmas cactuses. You actually deprive them of water and light, and then you hit them with light and water and they bloom. That's hormesis. That's this idea that you kind of push the organism into doing what we need. And there's actually studies showing that a little bit of radiation can be hormetic. I think of strength training or any kind of exercise that isn't, we don't want long-term chronic stress. We want hormetic bouts of stress.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So I saw that you did Ironmans. You know, like, to me, I think for most people, Ironmans are probably too long of a dose of stress. Like, for me, that would destroy me. But maybe for you, if we have different vitalities, we have different bodies, you know, for you, that might be the thing that really does it for your body. So everyone's different on that. But
it depends also how what you're training for. You know, if you're running every day, if you're swimming every week, then an Ironman may not be that hard, that tough, you know, for the body. But I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. So giving the body a bit of a challenge is always a good thing, but you have to rest it and refeed it and nourish it. Yeah. You can't just keep slamming it with stress. And that's hormesis. Mm. And hormesis is really, I think, the ticket to longevity. And all cellular organisms respond to hormetic stressors in really favorable ways if it's done right. And so that's kind of the ticket. Once I learned that, I was like, oh, okay, that's why we shouldn't be afraid to challenge our bodies and, you know, challenge our minds and do things, do hard things. Mm. Doing hard things is good for us.
And if you, I mean, I was thinking when I listened to this the other day about hormesis, I thought that maybe anti-nutrients in plants, that could be a kind of hormesis. What do you say? I mean, if I follow a normally apply an animal-based diet, so I eat meat, fish, eggs, but I also like to put some herbs on top, which is a plant, right? And it's probably there are all kinds of anti-nutrients, but maybe that's a kind of hormesis.
I totally agree. Yeah, I totally agree. And it will stoke your endogenous antioxidant production. They say that it's not the antioxidants that we eat. Mm. It's actually what you just said. It's the constituents of those plant materials that stoke our own endogenous antioxidant production. Mm, that's really the benefit. It's not the antioxidants coming from the blueberries. It's the skin of the blueberries and some of the, you know, molecular construct of the blueberries that's stoking our own hormetic production of antioxidants. So and I have gone more carnivore and less plant-based, like to the point of cutting plants out completely for just a short while. I wasn't super huge on it, but my gut was a mess a few years ago. I had a parasite and I was really, really sick and I couldn't get on top of it. Mm. And so I do think for some people, certain plants are not their friend. Maybe they need to be cooked or steamed. It's different for everyone. And so while I personally, I cannot eat leafy greens. I've learned that the hard way. Like I cannot do leafy greens. If I do, I have to do a little bit of arugula or something as a bitter to like, just kind of, but I can't do the big salad bowls I used to do. But I can tolerate some cooked vegetables. And in fact, I love most of the vegetables I like are actually the fruits, the squashes, zucchinis.
Yeah,
like
totally agree.
People don't think of those as fruits, but I love some of the tubers. Beans are not my friend. Whatever anti-nutrients are there are not helping me. So I think on social media, things get so polarized to get followers, right? People say the most crazy things. But at the end of the day, it's left up to the individual. Like oatmeal is not my friend. My gut does not like oatmeal. It's too much fiber. It's not a good food for me, but for others, maybe it is. I think the dogma, we got to get rid of the dogma and just understand. To me, it comes down to the fact that we have a variety of different types of teeth.
Yeah.
We have teeth to grind and we have teeth to cut. So I'm going to eat the things I need to grind and cut. That's it.
Tina, what about the sauna therapy? I had this sauna and cold bath installed in my house almost 2 years ago, and I'm addicted. I just love it. I do like 15 minutes in 100 degrees Celsius, and then I go into the cold bath for 6 minutes, then back into the sauna for another 15 minutes, cold bath, and then I finish with the sauna. So it's all together is 1 hour, and it's addictive because I just love it. When I'm at home, when I'm not traveling, I do this almost every evening.
Oh my gosh, that sounds amazing!
I love it. So I realize that you are actually into sauna therapy as well.
I am. Gosh, I am addicted too, and I sometimes will over sauna myself. So I will admit I've gone a little too far with it. My husband's like, you got to quit cooking yourself so much. And other times I'll neglect it. And then I wonder why I feel so crummy. And I'm like, oh, I haven't been actively saunaing. I think sauna is so miraculous. For me, it all came down to just trying to stay warm during Oregon winters and trying to stave off, because I have chronic pain and I was just trying to stave off the chronic pain. But once I started researching it, and I'm sure a lot of that research, you know, as well, it's just phenomenal. The benefits are phenomenal. And I think I think in both cases, the hot and the cold comes down to heat shock proteins and cold shock proteins. But I'm a naturopathic physician, and hydrotherapy and water cure are a huge part of our training. And so I've always really appreciated the benefits of hot and cold and water. And to me, this is such an individual, it's really an individual beautiful therapy for people. And I'm not a huge fan of you know, protocols, because not all of us, again, have the vitality to handle maybe the hot or the cold that someone else can handle. And so I think of sauna, and I love the alternating. The reason being is when you're in the hot, you are vasodilating. And when you're in the cold, you're vasoconstricting. So it's not just heat shock and cold shock, but you're actually pumping your blood and your lymph, which is such a beautiful way to get things moving when maybe say somebody is infirm or they're ill or they're unable to go exercise. Sauna is an exercise mimetic, as cold therapy is a bit too, you know. So that contrast that you're doing, I think, is really the key.
The contrast is amazing, I think.
Yeah, that's a huge one. And, you know, you're Swedish and in Finland and in Russia. I mean, all of these different countries, like, this has been the thing forever, right? Like in Finland, they get out of the sauna and they jump in the freezing cold lake. They might do that in Sweden too. I don't know.
That sounds crazy.
Yeah. Sounds amazing. And we used to do that at my mentor's house. We get out of the sauna and jump in the freezing cold.
It's super popular in Sweden. I think the last 10, 15 years, it's gone super. And all these people doing the, you know, the Instagram videos of themselves jumping into the cold water. Yeah, it's very popular.
It's really a wonderful therapy. And it's, you know, people can meet themselves wherever they're at. So if they're really, really sick or they're coming out of a bad illness, sometimes just getting in the shower and putting your arms and legs under the cold can be really therapeutic. Just, you know, in old hydrotherapy, there's still actually a few hydrotherapy spas around Europe, especially in Germany. And they'll have like an area that's kind of a running water area, and you just dip your arms or legs in. You don't completely submerge necessarily. You meet your body where it's at. And I think that's the beautiful part about it, is people can actually utilize these therapies in their home. They're free.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, hot bath, cold shower, we can do that too. It doesn't have to be such severe contrast, especially when somebody is coming out of an illness, or maybe they're chronically ill and they're trying to rebuild their vitality. You know, hot bath, cold shower is also really, really helpful. But
what are the main benefits? my setup is just amazing. I love it.
I need photos. I need to mimic this.
Yeah, I did actually. I've done one video of that. I'll do more. It's I'll do more.
Well, I'll go look on your Instagram.
The main benefits of like doing this regularly.
Well, I think hugely is cardiovascular is going to be huge. So again, it's hormesis, right? Like it goes back to hormesis. So we are hormetically stressing our systems, and how much you can take of that is up to you. And it's awesome. And that right there will give you a big bang for your buck. The cardiovascular benefits are huge. They did that long-term study on Finnish men and women and showed really extreme cardiovascular benefits. And it increased with it, you know, sauna sessions per week. So the more, the better kind of thing. We stoke the immune system. I think that's a big one. You decrease your risk for pneumonia significantly when you sauna regularly. And that to me is a big winner, because I used to get pneumonia all the time. And so every winter I got pneumonia and I was like, this is huge. The heat shock proteins, those are just molecules that get turned on when you get hot, and there's cold shock proteins that happen when you get cold. And all of those have different roles in our bodies. And they are hormetic. Too much of them will actually be detrimental. So I always think of it as like stoking your fire.
But you need to find the right balance, right? How do you advise your patients to find that right balance?
Well, I always tell them to make sure that they're well hydrated with electrolytes first, because just being dehydrated will screw the whole thing up, and then you feel horrible. You can't tolerate anything. I think a lot of people have low adrenal function and low hydration status and low electrolyte status, and they go into it and they're like, I can't do this. So I always say just slow and low, really slow and low. I am not trying to be heroic. I am not trying to even match what you're doing. I can't handle 6 minutes in that kind of cold. I can handle maybe 30 seconds. And I work my way up, but my husband can handle a whole different ball game. He's just got a whole different set of
it. But also I would say you get used to it, because at the beginning I did like 1 minute, 2 minutes, and then now I feel 6 minutes is just fine. So I think you need to listen to your body, right? And to little by little.
Just slow and low. Just make a commitment to the process and just slowly but surely work your way where you need to go. And don't listen to influencers online telling you to do these really extreme things, because we all are different. Yeah. And if your cardiovascular system is compromised, you actually can induce a heart attack. And I just, I think a lot of the stuff that we see is like, I've seen Joe Rogan in his ice bath for so long and I'm like, that's crazy. Like that was not, that would not help me. I would come out of that more depleted than I went in. I think that's the point. It really is. We're trying to come out feeling better. We want to come out of the whole thing feeling awesome, not like, oh my gosh, I got to go take a nap and I wrecked myself. So listen to your body.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, so blood pressure. I heard you talking about blood, high blood pressure. What are some common misunderstandings about the causes of high blood pressure?
That's a good question. It's a really misunderstood situation, I think. At least in the United States. I believe that the root cause of high blood pressure in almost all cases is insulin resistance and metabolic dysfunction, or, you know, pre-diabetes to up to diabetes. I think that's what's actually causing a lot of the blood pressure issues we're seeing. We know that salt itself is not the enemy. It's salt in the presence of high insulin. So when someone has a high insulin level and then they're eating a lot of salt, especially if it's salt that is dead, I think of, you know, table salt as dead salt instead of actual sea salt. Salt that has all the minerals present. So we want to be eating whole salt that's nutrient rich, mineral rich, and we want to be keeping our metabolic health in check, which is what the drum I'm always beating, right? So that's the big one. Because if you are metabolically dysfunctional, which is like what 96% of US adults at this, or 94 per the last study. And that last study was in 2018. The data was from 2018. So like, I'm sure it's much worse now. So I'm guessing like almost 100% of US adults are metabolically dysfunctional and have some insulin resistance to some degree. Yeah. And then they're throwing a bunch of crappy table salt, which has only got two minerals in it. And they're, you know, wondering why their blood pressure is going up. I think the second thing is, well, this is like a whole other conversation, but it's the idea of structured water. We are crystals. We are liquid crystals. Like that is how our body is made, through this structured water. This, they call it easy water, exclusion zone water. And have you heard of this?
No, I haven't.
Oh, this is a whole, I am not the expert on this, but you're going to trip
out. Tell me more.
So water is actually not just H2O. It's in a crystal structural state. And there's this idea that I completely believe this because I could feel this in people's tissues. I did all my medicine was musculoskeletal. My hands were on all my patients. And some people just felt really sort of flaccid and flat, and other people have good turgor. And I was like, what's the difference I'm feeling in the tissues here? It's not just swelling. It's like, there's something different about people who have good like turgor in their tissues.
Yeah.
And structured water is basically your water exists in a crystalline structure, and it vortexes through your vascular system, and that is how your blood pumps. It's not just the heart pumping, but there's no way the heart pumping could get blood out to here and then it could come back. And it's this structure. And then you've got this glycocalyx lining the insides of your vessels, your arteries. Yeah. And that glycocalyx needs, it's a kind of a sugar structure, but it's also crystalline. It has to be healthy in order for this structured water to move through. So guess what structures your water? Infrared, sunlight, movement. There's this electrical signal that goes through your mitochondria, and it's all tied together. So anyway, think of yourself as like a gelled, it's like a crystal gel. That's what we are. So anyway, I think a lot of people are, and then things like EMF, chronic stress, bad food, you know, all the things, those are going to destructure your water. So I think a lot of people are dealing with heart disease because there's too big of a load on their heart because their water is not structured and they're not doing the things to keep themselves structured, which, again, I'm not the expert. I can point you in the direction of the experts, but man, it's crazy when you get into it and it makes so much sense. So.
Fascinating. Yeah. So you mentioned, Tina, insulin resistance in relation to metabolic health. How does this typically manifest in patients?
Well, unfortunately, it doesn't show itself very readily. And so most people will be walking around with this for 10, 15 years before they even get any kind of sign or symptom. And usually the first symptom is blood pressure elevation. So that's usually the first sign is they'll start to get, and they'll start to, not always, but often they'll start to pack on some midsection fat. They'll start to get some visceral fat. You might see skin tags. You might, so skin tags around like the neckline or different areas of the body. You might actually see what's called acanthosis nigricans. It's a darkening or like a velvet darkening of the skin. It's more often you'll see it in people of color. And you'll start to get it, it, maybe the ankles or the wrists or the neck, you'll start to, or anywhere that there's rubbing of the clothes, you might start to see this sort of darkening of the tissue or this velvety look of dark tissue. That's another one. Their brains start shrinking. So cognition starts to go, and this explains a lot. This explains a lot about the United States. If everybody's insulin resistant, then and everyone's brains are shrinking because of it, you see the problem. So we've got that issue on hand. But yeah,
Europe is not much better. You know, so in the US it's 95%. I think in Europe it's 80-85%. So it's not that much better here.
My husband keeps trying to convince me to move to Italy, and I'm like, I was hoping it would be better. So those are some of the big ones, but usually what happens, unfortunately, is folks will go into this insulin resistant pre-diabetic, or, you know, they call it metabolic syndrome, and they'll rock that out for 15, 20 years. They'll start to have all kinds of terrible changes happening inside their body, as their body is literally like caramelizing. Their cells are caramelizing, if you will. And then they get diagnosed one day, they hit the magic number of, you know, fasting glucose of 120, and the doctor says, oh, you have type 2 diabetes. By the time that happens, your metabolism is a disaster. Like, that is a disastrous place to be. And so I always clinically, that's why my colleagues made fun of me, because clinically I was trying to catch it really early. You might see some changes in your lipids, so your cholesterol might start going up. Again, right? High blood pressure, high cholesterol in America and most other places, we treat that with medications to lower both, but no one ever bothers to look at the insulin resistance as the cause, as the root cause of all of this. And so you might have a harder time actually, as the visceral fat grows or the fat in the belly section, you start to get atrophy of the appendages. So this is why you see people maybe that look like little apples and their arms and legs are really skinny. If you're having a hard time hanging onto muscle, that's another sign. So it's a really vicious cycle, and we got to nip it in the bud early.
So how important is regular exercise in preventing metabolic syndrome?
Huge, because your muscles act as giant mops for your blood sugar. So they do a lot of things, actually. But the main thing, just for simplicity's sake, is I think of it as sort of a glucose mop. And so when the insulin resistance is essentially, your cells quit hearing the signal from insulin to let glucose in the cell. Insulin helps shuttle glucose into the cell to be used as fuel. And so when the cell starts, when it's bathing in too much high blood sugar and too much insulin, because the body's kind of gone awry, it starts cleaving off receptors. And in doing so, the cells think they're starving. Your brain thinks you're starving, but your body is now hoarding all of your calories into your fat cells, because that's what insulin does. It moves everything into your fat cells. So the person's getting fatter and they're starving all the time. It's a real mess, right? And then we start getting brain changes as far as appetite goes and signaling. It's a whole disaster zone. So anyway, exercise helps not only keep things moving, but it helps you build more glucose receptors, right? The more muscle you have, the more glucose receptors you have, the more opportunity you have to shuttle
And you're able
things.
To absorb that glucose.
Yeah. So that's the simplest version. There's other things that happen too, but I think of it that way. Like just build an insulin and glucose mop by building muscle. And I think there's benefits to some cardio too. And, you know, just movement, like walking is really phenomenal as well, but it's not the only thing you need to do. You need to strength train. I think walking and strength training are probably two of the most potent things to implement for everybody, every age, old people, young people, men and women.
Yeah.
So in your opinion, how important is glucose monitoring for someone trying to optimize their metabolic health?
I think it's really important. I did not realize it until I was always doing the finger stick method, you know, and I've had patients, my mentor was having people back in the 90s, checking themselves, non-diabetics, checking themselves with the at-home little finger stick devices. Mm. And I always thought, well, why? And he had them in stock in his clinic, and he would sell them out of his clinic. And I was like, why are you doing that? They're not diabetic. And he's like, because we don't want them to become diabetic. He really taught me the importance of catching people early. We wait until people are down that disaster highway, like I mentioned. And it's such a bad mess. And it's like, can we get them earlier? That would be great. Anyway, continuous glucose monitors, I had no idea so many other factors were playing a role. Like, I didn't realize what my stress was doing to me. I didn't realize what a poor night's sleep was doing to me. I mean, I knew the data said that if you screw up your sleep for several nights in a row, you'll become transiently insulin resistant. But I didn't realize like what it was doing to me personally. I didn't realize what certain foods were doing or not doing, you know, things that I thought would raise it that didn't, or food combining is actually more what I noticed. Like, if as long as I eat beef, I can pretty much eat anything I want after that.
I was about to ask you that. When it comes to food, what advice would you give to someone trying to maintain healthy glucose levels?
Well, I'm really blown away at what beef does, because I've gone out and had steak dinners and I've eaten mashed potatoes and, you know, cheesecake and rolls and drank alcohol, done all of that with the steak. And my blood sugar is just like whoop on my continuous glucose monitor. It's nice and even.
Yeah.
But if I eat, you know, carbohydrates in the morning and no protein and no fat, it's the whole day
is
a bunch of, it's a bunch of spikes, and it's the amount of spikes and how high they go. That's really the problem, right? Like, we don't want to just constantly be spiking our blood sugar. So I found that different types of proteins react differently in me. Chicken and shrimp and fish don't really stabilize my blood sugar as well as beef. Beef, I think it's the fat content in the beef. I think it's the saturated fat that really does it for me personally. I am not saying that's for everyone. Buffalo, any kind of ruminant animal, any animal with more than one stomach tends to do good for me. Red meat.
For me too. I mean, I think beef is, grass-fed beef is the best.
Oh man, it's so nutrient rich too. And just for me personally, I have had such severe zinc deficiencies my whole life, and they manifest in the weirdest ways. I mean, something that most people don't realize is if you have a young woman, like a teenage girl, and she starts to show signs of anorexia or low appetite, anxiety, acne, all of the things we think about with like skinny, neurotic teenage girls, that's usually a zinc deficiency. And getting zinc up in the body is really difficult with supplements. It's just, for 10 years, I was pounding zinc to my detriment. If you take too much zinc, you inhibit your immune system. So I could not get these white spots on my fingernails to leave until I started eating beef every single day. I eat beef every single day. My cholesterol is so low. It's too low. I can't get it up if I tried. I feel great, and all of my zinc issues are resolved. I feel so much better. Yeah, calmer, happier. All the white spots are gone off my fingernails. My fingernails are strong. I'm absorbing my iron. My chronic anemia has disappeared. So
beef is a solution.
It's a superfood. It really is. Yeah. And I'll challenge my followers once in a while, like the people on my email list. I'll say, okay, I want you to eat beef every day for the next 5 days and come back and tell me how you feel. And everyone's like, God, I feel better. I feel calmer. I feel more alert.
I
think it's a really nutritious, highly nutrient dense, highly absorbable nutrients.
So going back a moment to the glucose spikes. Because I heard you talking about the body's resilience to occasional glucose spikes. Could you expand on that?
So say it again, the body's resilience to what?
The body's resilience to get these occasional glucose spikes.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't worry about them so much if they happen and then they come down and things regulate out. If they go up and they stay up, and then they spike again and they stay up, that's somebody who's not handling their blood sugar well. Things are not going in the right direction. So it's not the spike I'm so worried about. It's the frequency of them, and it's how long things stay up there.
Okay.
That's the real problem. And so if you're eating sugar or refined carbohydrates all day, you're going to spike it all day. And if you're eating too many carbohydrates and not enough protein and fat, you're going to spike it and it's going to stay up. That's basically you bathing in insulin, and insulin is pro-grow. It's really helpful right after a strength training workout because it helps you grow muscle, but it's also pro-cancer. It's pro everything, right? It's pro-grow. So we don't want to be swimming in insulin all day. And with the blood sugar spikes comes the insulin spike. So we want to, we want to just like spike again. I think of it as hormesis. If I'm going to double down on some fruit, I'm going to go use it. Like I'm going to, I'm going to, if I have a, I always say earn your carbohydrates. It was Charles Poliquin who coined that. And I totally agree. Like I'm going to strength train today. So I'm going to have some carbs tonight and I'm not going to worry about the glucose spike. And then I'm generally going to go for a walk after I eat the carbohydrates to kind of work it into my system and get my blood sugar down. So it's not so much being afraid of the spikes as it is just not having them constantly and keeping things up. Okay. That's more my jam.
Okay. So a couple more questions because we're wrapping this up. What about hormonal health? Because thyroid issues, thyroid, how do you say that in English? Thyroid?
Thyroid?
Thyroid, sorry.
Yeah.
Thyroid issues. Okay. So particularly in women of over 40 years, they seem so common. What, from your perspective, what factors are contributing to this trend?
I think every woman over 40 should consider thyroid replacement. That's straight up. That I will hold to that. I've thought that for years and years. That's the other thing my colleagues tease me about. They're like, Dr. Tina thinks everybody has hypothyroidism. And I'm like, that's because most of them do. What contributes to it? To answer your question, though, is I think toxicity is a huge player. I think we live in a really toxic environment and we're swimming in it all day, you know, and we can only do what we can do. I think that definitely crushes thyroid. We also feed ourselves all day long, like a food trough, you know, we're just constantly. And so this is where I think some degree of intermittent fasting is helpful because we don't want to, we can overfeed our thyroid, if you will. If we, I have found clinically and for myself as well, that if you give yourself some windows of fasting, your thyroid tends to work better than if you're constantly, you know, grubbing down on food. And then it's kind of the canary in the coal mine. It just gets hit really hard, especially when the adrenal system goes down. So if a lot of chronic stress is happening and your hypothalamic pituitary axis is getting hit, then, and that can be chronic stress. It can be a severe illness. It can be, you know, a death in the family. It can be a lot of things, but if your adrenal system gets hit, then your poor thyroid is going to get pulled down with it. And that's a really elementary way to explain it, but that's what happens. And so I think chronic stress will tank out your thyroid, over-exercising, under-exercising, and it really sucks. And it leads to a lot of brain fog, a lot of depression. It leads to stagnation of your metabolism. It doesn't necessarily, it's hard to say. It definitely contributes to weight gain, but just going on thyroid hormone isn't necessarily going to make you lose weight. That's a real tricky one that people don't always understand. But yeah, I think of thyroid hormone as a longevity treatment, not so much let's treat the hypothyroidism. I think everybody, even including men, could use a small dose of desiccated thyroid to really optimize their longevity and their health. So I'm just a big fan of, I'm a big fan of it.
All right. And what about the anti-nutrients in plants? Do they, how do they affect the thyroid?
Yeah, that can glom things up as well. So I had one patient, we had her on a weight loss protocol and she was doing really well. And then she came in and I don't know what got into her, but I said, well, what are you eating? Because she stalled out. I was like, what is going on? And she said she was just chopping up raw cauliflower and raw broccoli and eating that all day with steak. And I was like, well, that might be a problem because we know that the cruciferous vegetables can be what are called goitrogen. So they can contribute to a low thyroid state. If you cook them or steam them, you're going to be better off. But just even that, like the amount she was eating, that really showed me that like that can be a real stall, like that can stall things. So we don't, again, to people's tolerance, right? And I don't think most people realize what their tolerance to foods are until they remove the food and then reintroduce it. And so for me, I removed plants from my diet and then reintroduced them to tolerance. And I'm a big fan of cooking and steaming and making sure we break down some of those anti-nutrients before we ingest them. I think that that helps. But yeah, I also think people are protein starved. And when you're when you're starved for protein and healthy fats, none of your hormones go well.
No.
So yeah, I think it's a balance.
So what do you think about these, like the medicines, Ozempic, for example, what do you think about them?
The weight loss wonders.
Weight loss wonders, exactly.
They are They are a class of medications called GLP-1 agonists. So they stimulate the GLP-1 receptor in your body, which are all over your body. They're in all these different organ systems of our bodies. And they've been in use since the mid-2000s. So they're not new. The ones you're hearing about currently are the newest iterations, but these types of drugs have been around for a very long time and used to treat type 2 diabetes. But it turns out they've been studied for a long time as well. And one of the things they do is they work by slowing down your gastric motility. So they make you feel fuller longer. But that's just the most basic. That's like one thing they do. They also work in the brain to control the appetite signaling in certain regions of the brain and certain hormones like ghrelin and leptin. They have an impact on and dopamine. And when everybody was vilifying them, like there were so many people online, both in the, you know, functional health space and then in the mainstream media that were just like crapping all over these peptides, they're strings of amino acids bound together. They're peptides. I was like, what is going on? Why is everybody hating on these so much? Like, they can't be that dangerous. There's a ton of people on them. There's like, this can't be that bad. And so I started looking into it and turns out we secrete our own GLP-1 from certain regions of our brain. So it's it's critical for certain aspects of brain function. And we secrete it from our L cells that are like L as in Lucy, that are inside of our gut, that are in our duodenum, in our small intestine. And some people, if you look at the data, obese individuals and diabetics, type 2 diabetics, actually will often be GLP-1 deficient. So they're taking a medication that's actually replenishing what they're missing. But it also, like, the from top to bottom, basically just a quick rundown, not to belabor it, but decreases neuroinflammation. So decreases inflammation in the brain, decreases pain, decreases autoimmune disease, decreases addiction habits, like not just eating or overeating, it decreases the desire for alcohol, cigarettes, cocaine, on and on. And it's being studied for all of this. It's got cardiovascular really, really wonderful, imparts cardiovascular protection. It actually has been shown to regenerate cardiovascular cells. It's a
miracle medicine.
Well, it regenerates neurons. It regenerates the pancreas. I think if done appropriately, I think what's happening is people are being overdosed on it and they are being started at too high of a dose and they're being kept on too high of a dose for too long. But yeah, I think it's a pretty, and in the biohacking community, it's been used for a variety of things and with really good results. My daughter's PCOS has completely reversed on it. My depression and pain has gone down significantly. I always get the seasonal affective disorder here in Oregon. And I'm just talking micro doses of it, like really small doses.
All right.
Really, really profound impact. Not for everyone, not telling everyone to take it. Disclaimer, I'm not anyone's doctor, but I've done some podcasts on it if people are interested, and the data on it's pretty compelling.
Great, Tina. This has been a pleasure. Where can people find you?
Yes, it's so fun. Thanks for having me on. You can find me on Instagram. I'm at Dr. Tina, D-R-T-Y-N-A. And that's also my website, drtina.com. And then I have a podcast called The Dr. Tina Show, which I would love to have you come on as a guest. It would be so fun to ask you all the questions too. Yeah. And you could talk about your cool sauna and cold plunge setup. So that's where people can find me. And on my website, I have a free guide that people can download if they want to learn more about metabolic health. So, yeah.
Great. Thank you so much for listening to the Hunger for Change podcast. I hope you enjoyed the episode. I also wanted to take a moment to talk about Naturally, my brand of healthy food products. At Naturally, we are on a mission to change the world through what we eat. This is why we worked so hard to make products that are delicious and also good for you. They're all gluten-free, have no refined sugars, no sweeteners, and no additives. My personal favorites are the cheesy snacks, chocolates, and cacao hazelnut spread. We also have cookies, granolas, nut bars, nut butters, and protein powders, as well as many cool snacks to be released soon. At the moment, Naturally is only available in Europe. However, we're working to expand to other continents, so stay tuned. If you're in Spain, you can head over to our website, naturally.com, and it will take you to our online store. And if you're in Italy, Portugal, Germany, Poland, France, the Netherlands, or in Sweden, you can find them on Amazon. Search for Naturally. I will leave you all these links in the description anyway, so that you can find them. Thank you so much for listening, and stay tuned for the next episode.